It is time to bring in David Tarachuk with The Media Beat. David has his own website, which is themediabeat.us, but he's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief, and we review news stories and the way media has covered it over the past week and possible upcoming stories. Good morning, David.
Well, it's good to be with you again, reporting in from the media capital of the world, New York City, once more.
You know, I've basically been showing video clips, but finally this morning a security camera video was released of that horrible collapse of basically half of a condo housing in Florida. And when you look at it, you definitely see structural problems with one portion of it falling on pancaking on one another and another. This is just a story that comes up, and I know it's not public infrastructure, but it is. It's a private building, but people live in it. Once again, it really points towards the infrastructure in this country.
Well, yes, those images from Surfside, just north of Miami, right by the intracoastal highway there, Collins Avenue, known to many of us who have been to Miami. It's a horrific sight, and of course the sort of neutral positioning of and the view, neutral viewpoint, if you like, of just surveillance cameras, security cameras, not the work of a of a news crew or even a you know, someone posting on social media from their iPhone. It had a curiously static and steady look at something that was horrific in its movement, the collapse downward of an entire wing of the building, the condo building. What was it? It was 12 stories high, and you could see as the corner coming away reveals all those still remaining condos in part, making it look like a sort of grim version of a doll's house. You see the people's remaining sections of their own homes left there exposed to the air. It has a particular ring for this journalist. My journalism career started back in 1968, and there was the most appalling collapse of a building there, which is still famous in the British Isles, a building called Ronan Point, which was much higher. It was 22 stories high, and there four people died. It's amazing that more didn't. There were many, many, many injured, and the images are terribly redolent now from this from this Florida case. The building in the British case was brand new, and an architect, a British architect, had been warning for months in a totally unheard fashion, unlistened to, that the particular form of construction was not to be trusted. And appallingly, he turned out to be so right. In the Florida case, it's a matter of fact that that applies across the entire country. When you come to mention infrastructure, of course, that this building was 40 years old, and it had featured in various reviews of buildings in Florida, and which at that particular part of Florida has to take into account, of course, the reviews have to take into account, of course, the exposure to salt water air and high winds, these are things that made the building a prime candidate for inspection, and an inspection was due. Some repair work had already started on the roof. And of course, we don't know yet, and speculation is the hobgoblin of journalism, of course, and we step into speculative territory at our own risk. But it's pretty clear that this building was an aging building, and it was a candidate to be considered in need of overhaul, and then suddenly only 30 hours ago at 1:30 to 2 o'clock in the morning, suddenly a corner of the building starts to crumble, and it's horrific. It's astonishing that only one death has been reported so far. I feel it's inevitable that amongst the almost 100 people who are still not accounted for, that there will be more fatalities. And it's one of those grim stories that makes us think very seriously about how we regulate the free-reigning business of a country which trusts so much to private enterprise, to the building of our own homes and often public buildings too. It's worth reflecting on the other big again from Britain. I can't help having these experiences because that's where I'm from. But in Britain, just 4 years ago, there was a terrible Grenfell Tower fire. That was a subsidized rent building in North Kensington in London. That was a terrible case of a fire taking place, and because of poor construction choices done out of the sharpest of motives, a private builder to minimize cost, the aluminum cladding and the other compound that was involved in the cladding on the outside of the building, alongside the thin membrane of aluminum, was combustible, and it cost about £2, about $3 more per piece than the non-inflammable kind. And it was combustible, and boy, did it combust. Flames right up the building. And of course, 72 people dead in that case, and hundreds, hundreds injured. So these stories will bring out some of the best in journalism, as well as sometimes I fear the worst, the kind of ghoulish attention to the grim sight. But I hope that some of the best of journalism will be applied to finding out what's behind this collapse. There will be an official inquiry too, of course. That's being delayed at the moment while public officials put the emphasis on the rescue effort, search and rescue effort that's being done. Those classic scenes that always make my skin crawl a little bit because of my experience in such situations, the sight of dogs going along to sniff out what might be human remains, but might, just might, be a living human still. All that is so relevant, and it tugs at the heartstrings, and the search and rescue is, of course, so vitally important, but at the same time, those same public authorities in charge of that will, in time, and short time, I hope, announce a public investigation into this. But meanwhile, journalism has its responsibility, too, to try and find out what may have lain behind this terrible disaster.
And David, what came out this morning, and once again, this is where professional journalism works out. Once again, there were reporters that went back through building records, okay, public records, and this building did find out that a portion of the building was sinking faster than other portions of the building. The company, I guess they were aware of it, and they had probably just started to begin. But once again, this is where good journalism takes away a lot of the tall tales that can come out when a disaster like this happens. But once again, a grim scene in South Florida, no doubt about it. I want to move on to... I hate to do this to the other guy, but once again, Mike Pence has jumped into the fray. I figure he figures he's got nothing to lose because he's not.
Mike Pence has nothing to lose right now. I think you could be right by saying that.
He once again rebuked President Trump yesterday on the question of overturning the results of the presidential election. He said he'll always be proud of his role in affirming election results. Following the riot, they came at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library, but he did offer an assessment of the former president's claims in the days leading up to it. Quote, "The Constitution affords the vice president no authority to reject or return electoral votes submitted to the Congress by the states," and that That basically means that Pence contradicts everything that Donald Trump said, and not without mentioning the former guy by name. He said, quote, "Those in our party who believe that any one person could select the president, truth is, there's almost no idea more un-American than the notion that any one person can choose the American president."
Well, yes, Pence is speaking out, something that Pence rarely did, of course, when he was the super loyal number two to the former guy. One journalistic comment I noticed in the wake of this speech, which I suppose you could say required some political courage, but that's a sign of the times, isn't it, to say that it needs courage to say the simple truth that he was pointing out. But the journalistic analysis that I warmed to most was when I read the phrase that Mr. Pence is now testing the patience of a man who still looms over the political landscape and the Republican Party. Yes, I mean, that's the essence of what we're coping with now in terms of what is sometimes perhaps a little sort of ironically nowadays called the loyal opposition. The Republican Party, now in opposition, is in a very peculiar state. Loomed over, in that phrase I just mentioned, loomed over by one man, the former guy. And you know, it does, I suppose, take some political courage to move away from him. And so it's to be said with some degree, I think, of welcome that we can look at certain developments in Washington at the moment and say, well, perhaps the influence of the former guy is not as severe as we might have thought. The group of 10, the senators from two sides, coming together, five Republicans, and they're the brave ones, I suppose, and five Democrats, to make an agreement with the Biden administration on the infrastructure package, being agreed yesterday, and Biden stepping forward and saying in a way that is, I think, a kind of, maybe I'm stretching this now, but it is almost a kind of mockery of a phrase that the former guy used to use a lot. And Biden said, we have a deal. And sure, yeah, we now have a bipartisan deal, a remarkable thing in today's political climate. The infrastructure package is not as big as Biden wanted, but it's two-thirds the size of what he wanted. Remarkably, you know, five leading Republicans, ones, of course, we knew from before, during the Trump era, of course, to be opposed to Trump anyway. So it's no great, there's not been no great conversions achieved by this alliance, but it is a bipartisan alliance, and we can perhaps put that in the positive column as we assess how Washington is doing in these really bifurcated times when we're so polarized in so many things.
Well, here's the great thing about what President Biden announced yesterday is that at the same time, the portion that he could not get, they're going to approach a different way, which is budget reconciliation. And so that whole package will go for, and he said he will not sign one without the other. So it's going to be very interesting to see if those 5 to 10 key Republicans can get to that number 60 needed in the Senate to
right.
pass this.
As a British politician once said famously, a week is a long time in politics. So, and also that the politics is the art of the possible. So, sure, Biden shifting his ground now, saying that we can do this in separate parts, and that one part is every bit as important as the other part. And in this case, we're talking, of course, about regarding infrastructure in a broad definition. What is, it's as if the agreement that was reached yesterday applies just to the hardware, if you like, of infrastructure, the nuts and bolts, the highways, the bridges, that kind of thing. Though, interestingly, it does include broadband provision for the country as a whole. That's a welcome step into the ether away from the nuts and the simple nuts and bolts economy. But the Biden plan, of course, is to also extend the infrastructure idea to what they're now calling human infrastructure, all the things that the Republicans said they didn't like about the previous overall package, things like childcare to enable people to get have their professional working lives made that bit easier, and of course elder care too, and also certain educational advantage measures that will help society in general prosper and make work that easier, and make job creation the job creation part of this whole policy that much more likely and much more widespread. So yes, the plan is clearly in the minds of the Biden administration to adopt as much flexibility as they can, but always move forward, and that is the next move forward that we can look forward to.
All right, and also under this administration, some very interesting times. China flexing its muscles against Taiwan, the British having their fleet take on China, and the United States not backing away from Russian ships. What I think this all comes back to is President Biden bringing back United States to the worldwide stage via NATO and via the EU meetings, and even the Putin meeting. I think this is it's gone unnoticed by a lot of people, but this is a very important step for America to reemerge on the world stage.
Yeah, the theme that Biden was stressing when he was in Europe last week with the G7 meeting under the hosting presence of Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, and the sort of comity that he was stressing there, and then in Europe and with the EU and with NATO, particularly with NATO, and then of course his assumption of the position of leader of the free world, that old phrase again, when he met Putin. All of this suggests, in Biden's phrase, or is supporting the notion that is formulated in Biden's phrase, America is back. Now, that might seem a little crude to some people's ears, but it's in broad terms, it's probably to be welcomed. It certainly makes a big difference from the confusion and unreliability that characterized those 4 years of the former guy. But the other thing that Biden is also doing on the international stage, which is worth emphasizing alongside this idea that America is back, is that America is also leaving. America is leaving Afghanistan. Now, both Biden and the former guy would often use the phrase the forever war, or the endless war in Afghanistan. And yet Biden is the one who is actually pulling out. Trump made a big point in his own campaigning that he would leave Afghanistan. Well, he didn't. Like other presidents before him, he was persuaded to stay, and indeed to reinforce the United States' presence in some ways. But Biden is carrying out his promise and is leaving by the 20th anniversary of 9/11, which prompted the Afghan war in the first place. My own journalistic engagement with Afghanistan predates what's been called the endless war or the forever war. Long before 2001, way back in the 90s, I was with the United Nations concentrating on, among other stories, the appalling refugee problems being suffered by the Afghans, because for them, the forever war has been that much more literally, much more meaningfully, and their experience of war stretches way back to the Soviet invasion of their country, of course, and the fight against that by an alliance that was essentially led in the end by religious militants, the Mujahideen, who, interestingly enough, the Americans then supported with CIA covert support and the provision of deadly arms. So this long war has been a lot longer for the Afghanistan, for the Afghans, than it has been for the United States. But what the interesting thing is, that it is this administration now that is carrying through the final withdrawal, with all the downside as well as the upside that comes with that. It's interesting to note that after a lot of pressure and a lot of good reporting about the Afghans who will suffer by the American withdrawal, in particular Afghans who helped American forces and the American presence in general in Afghanistan, who have come under terrible pressure, many of them being killed, of course, and their families hurt as well. The support staff for the American presence, the interpreters, the drivers, the clerks, all those people who have been attacked and will continue to be attacked unless they're taken to safety. And Biden himself finally agreed and announced publicly yesterday that there will be an emergency evacuation of these people. And one can only say, thank goodness. Where they're going isn't quite clear yet, possibly to Guam, the American territory in the Pacific. There's some perhaps belated effort to do what, in my parlance, when I was when I've been covering wars, is the principle of OCD, and I don't mean obsessive compulsive disorder. I mean ordinary common decency, which I think dictates that you do look after people who helped you in even in the messiest of situations. The Taliban have been actually killed an interpreter who headed a family who mercifully managed to arrive in Texas in Houston Airport, the George Bush Airport, ironically enough, in Houston. The family arrived yesterday, but the interpreter himself was killed by the Taliban a few weeks ago. So that's the realities of an engagement that still play out, but it's an engagement which, in broad terms at least, is going to end in September this year.
And one final note to bring up to you. It's not only the Democrats that come up with dumb ideas like defund police. I am just amazed at what happened when a top general rebuked the criticism of the military being woke, and all of a sudden Republicans and Fox News called for defunding the Defense Department. I mean,
yes, words fail me. It's an interesting, the language of political abuse is always an interesting phenomenon to observe. That borrowing that word woke and turning it into an insult is a feature of the present day political landscape, I'm afraid. And yes, the notion of five-star generals or whatever number of star generals being amongst the woke community, and therefore to be trounced and condemned by Fox News is an interesting one. It's rather like the Republicans who are refusing to acknowledge the role the self-sacrifice, indeed, of police at the Capitol. If ever there was a political party wedded to supporting the police, you would think it was the Republican Party. But, it's been turned on its head in a topsy-turvy sort of way that only Gilvan Sullivan could really portray. That's happening in the issue of the Capitol insurrection or riot or whatever you'd like to call it. Invasion is a good enough phrase for me. And we're here in these as I described earlier, the polarized times when the insults traded get to be somewhat crazy.
Well, the Joint Chiefs Chair, by the way, may I say, who was appointed by Donald Trump, Mark Milley, here's what he said, and this is, I don't always agree with the Joint Chiefs, but they do protect our country. He said, quote, "I personally find it offensive that we are accusing the United States military of being woke or something else because we're studying some theories that are out there. I want to understand white rage, and I'm white," Milley told lawmakers. He continued with this quote, "What is it that caused thousands of people to assault this building and try to overturn the Constitution of the United States of America? I've read Mao Zedong, I've read Karl Marx, I've read Lenin. That doesn't make me a communist. So what's wrong with understanding?"
That's the best part of his speech, I think.
Yeah. I mean, it's just simple. I just don't understand the Republican positioning. I know that they want to try to get back the House and Senate in 2022. I don't think this is the way to do it. This is as dumb as the progressive wing coming up with defund police. It just doesn't make any sense, and it will only cause angst.
I guess you're right, but how crazy can the Republicans get and stay? That is the big question for the next 2 years at the very least.
David, it's always great to talk with you. Have a great weekend.
You too.
David Tarachuk with the Media Beat. Once again, you can find David at his website, themediabeat.us, and you can find this show online, every edition of it, at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand, click on the Media Beat with David Tarachuk.